Okay, let us get started. Do we have any questions? The class is going to just tilt this side one of these days. There are more people here, less people that way. Question? So I assume you all got my mail that if you decided to take advantage of a flexible extension on Project 3, then you can't take it any other time. If you submitted it today, then you still have it in the bank. And so that's the idea. I assume enough people are done. That's good. Any questions on things that we discussed last time? Yes, sir.
No, about the extension policy.
I seem to get more meta questions than the real questions. Yes.
Is it, so for example, this one was due Thursday, but you can extend it to Tuesday. Will the next project also be due on a Thursday then?
I don't know. I don't know. So you don't look at gift horses in the mouth. So you're getting it free. Okay. I don't know. I mean, I think that's a minor issue. Other questions? Yes. You're going to write a Lisp program which does something equivalent to Prolog theorem proving. We don't use Prolog, we make Prolog. Yes, I mean. So, in fact, today we'll be discussing backward chaining, and which is essentially what, with some bells and whistles, that's what Prolog does. Okay. So it turns out backward chaining is mod exponents for first order logic done in the backward direction. And we will also talk about resolution refutation, but we'll spend more time talking about the backward chaining mod exponents, generalized mod exponents done in the backward direction, because even though it's not complete, it winds up being quite useful in many cases. Okay. Other questions? There was another raised hand somewhere. Yes.
Is that a ghost story from Halloween?
It's not a ghost story from Halloween. So for those of you who haven't seen this, I mean, some of you probably know this already, right? Okay, but those of you, and of course you have this knowing smile on your face, but the people who haven't seen this, this is connected to the class. I mean, if anything I put up there, sometimes I'll connect it up. So the question, of course, is, those of you who haven't seen it before, do you think there is a quandary there? Point one. And the more important issue is, whether you thought when you read the story first that there was a paradox that cannot be explained. And then did you find out that there is no paradox, or still there is a paradox? I'm not asking you to identify yourself, because it's a politically charged question here to some extent. But I guess the interesting thing is, I would be happy to admit to you that the first time when I read this, I thought, my God, I have no clue how this is happening. Okay. What's more interesting is, my nephew, my sister is a doctor, and I asked my nephew this question, and he basically came up with paranormal explanations as to how the dead father somehow came back as the surgeon. Okay. Now, why am I saying this? Is it because I want to make fun of my nephew or myself? No. Of course, I mean, in this particular case, those of you who haven't figured out, it's, I hope you're not there, surgeon is the mother of the boy. And we tend to assume, as soon as you say surgeon, we tend to assume most of us a male, and so we see that there is a quandary. I mean, there's a paradox, okay? And now, of course, after I tell you surgeon is female, I mean, of course, you'll hit yourself in the head. I'm sure you've seen surgeons who are female. And in fact, we could go a lot of discussion about sexist usage of language, etc., but that's not the issue. That's not the reason I brought this up here. The interesting thing is, if you do not specify the gender, you have to consider a person who is genderless in understanding the story. So you have to do case analysis. We are very bad at doing case analysis. Whenever there is a choice, if somebody does not tell us a specific, which is somebody doesn't give us the detail, rather than keep both the cases and keep them until one of the cases is violated. So in fact, the right thing to do here is when you first hear surgeon, you have to realize that surgeon can be male or female, and the male is out because the male guy who happens also to be the father of this guy is dead, and so dead people can't do operations, which in itself is an interesting background knowledge. We have this. And so the only thing left is female, and so the surgeon is a woman, right? But it's hard to do that. Case analysis is hard. And it's exactly when you do case analysis that you start doing, so in propositional reasoning, if you don't do case analysis, then you can get complete inferences with just modus ponens, which is linear time, it's polynomial time in the size of the database. It's when you start taking cases into consideration that it will become exponential. And resolution theorem proving differs from modus ponens in as much as it allows you to do case analysis. So what I'm trying to tell you is resolution theorem proving is unnatural. We don't do it. Okay? There have been enough cognitive studies showing that humans would jump to conclusions and retract, rather than keep all possibilities until the wrong ones are thrown out. Okay, so to some extent, a different way of looking at this story is, if you don't want people to make wrong conclusions, and if you really do want to, so in fact, this also came to my mind when I was writing this mail to the class, talking about whoever did well in the exam, and I was trying my best to not give away the gender of the person, did best. And so I had to say he or she, and then end it with she or he, and all this fun stuff. And when we are trying to write gender, non-gender biased English, we tend to start using things like they instead of saying he or she. Unfortunately, what this story is telling you is, when you say they, the reader is actually thinking of probably a male they. And if they are from India, they think of an Indian male day. And if you are from China, they think of Chinese male day. And if you really want them to think equally of men and women, you have to once in a while use she and once in a while use he. Okay? Now, every time you read a paper where the example starts with a she, it looks awkward because you haven't seen enough of those. Okay? But if you really want people, if your interest is for the reader to actually think equally of both genders, you cannot say they, because that's what I tried to do here, and it didn't work because you all thought of male surgeon. Okay, and you could have written this exact same story, and this is really nothing to do with, it's a stereotyping. We have to do stereotyping. Okay, to live in the world, we have to generalize from few examples. Okay, the real question, of course, is how do you make sure that you don't cause harm to people with your stereotypes? So if I could have written this story, presumably, where the mother dies and the nurse said, "This is my son," and that would be equally paradoxical, because most nurses that you have seen tend to be women. So male nurses are probably just as much in a minority as at the time when this story was written, female surgeons were. So it doesn't really matter how you came to it. If you want people, if you allow disjunction, people tend to jump to conclusions. That's point one. And point two is, disjunctions do make reasoning harder. And today we'll be talking, for first order logic inferences, we'll talk about generalized modus ponens, which does not handle disjunction. In fact, the main difference between modus ponens and resolution is, one allows the disjunction, one knows how to handle the disjunction, the other doesn't. What's the non-harm clause in the exam? It's the HRI, okay? So Is that the H? Is that, I mean, in the exam we had this, this is a good exam and this is what else exam?
Interesting.
Interesting, yeah. Hard and interesting. So HRI. So I, for some reason, kept thinking H must be happy. But anyway, so hard or interesting, HRI, that was the disjunction. And to deal with the disjunction, you had to do resolution theorem proving. You could not have used modus ponens to get all the inferences. Okay. Okay, enough of that. Here are a couple of things. It's a very minor point, but I should mention this about existential and universal quantification that several of you probably already know, which is that for all and there exists are connected through negation. And this is not surprising. This essentially is just a different version. So this first one is nothing but a different version of this, not of A and B is equal to not A or not B. That's exactly what you are saying there, because for all is a big conjunction. And if you put a negation in front of a big conjunction, and if you try to pull the negation in, it becomes a disjunction. So don't be surprised. It's, obviously you know this, and also there is no reason to be surprised at this. And then same thing. So this is just a minor equality, that equivalence that holds. Okay, so last time we were talking about model theoretic semantics for first order logic, and our plan of action was that maybe we can do first order logic by compiling it down to propositional logic. Okay, and then we know how to deal with model theoretic and semantics for propositional logic, because you just have these big truth tables and then consider all the rows where the all the interpretations under which the knowledge base holds, and then check if in all of them the fact that you want to prove also holds. If so, the entailment holds. That's the definition. So how could we do that? Well, it's not, I mean, as we said last time, in fact, in many cases, I mean, it's reasonably obvious that first order logic is sort of syntactic sugaring over propositional logic. For example, here, suppose you have for all x, king x, and greedy x implies evil x, king John, greedy John, brother Richard John. I could have written this, and suppose if my world contained only two constants, Richard and John, and no functions at all, because I have no functions here. So then really, this is equivalent to this. Right? Because for all is just a conjunction of this formula for the possible values of x. Okay. So these are the two instantiated versions of this particular one. And then these are just already instantiated anyway. Okay. In general, you would call a formula in first order logic ground if it has no variables. Okay. And so this is a ground database. There are no variables anymore. Okay, and so no quantifications, all the quantifications are removed and there are no variables. So this is a ground database. Now if you have this ground database, it really is equivalent to a propositional database, because you can think of this as king-john. I mean, this is a proposition symbol. This is a proposition symbol. That's a proposition symbol. So it you know, you can ignore the parentheses and just imagine that King John is a proposition symbol. And then anything that I can ask here, I can ask here. And, you know, and if I'm trying to prove some theorem, what might I want to prove? Is it the case, so I might want to be able to prove, I might want to say, is it true that John is evil? Okay, that's my question. I want to ask whether John is evil. Okay, I could write here, you know, not evil John, and then try to basically not even do not evil John. So I want to ask whether evil John is true. So I can draw a big truth table and compute the interpretations over which all these sentences hold together, and see if in all those interpretations whether evil John holds. If so, that's done. By the way, how many proposition symbols are there in this database? How big is the truth table going to be? You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and 7, right? So 2 power 7, so you just need a little table of 2 power 7 size, and then and then you will know in each interpretation, in each row, you know whether this whole database evaluates to true or not, and you can also see whether in each of those rows whether evil John evaluates to true. This is exactly what you did for propositional logic. So there is no difference between first order logic and propositional logic now. Okay. So I could have a query that you asked me here, I could answer it here. Okay. Furthermore, actually, let's just look at it this way. Suppose I didn't ask you this question, I didn't ask you the question of is John evil, but instead asked a more useful question, which is in fact one of the biggest things that first order logic allows you. Does there exist an evil person? Does there exist an evil person? In fact, when you do prologue, when you do first order logic theorem proving, this is the kind of queries that are more interesting, because you're saying, does there exist an object which has certain set of properties? Okay, so is there an object which has the property evil? Okay, now I can answer that here too. And basically you would say, yes, they know they does exist because evil John is true. Now how do I do that in this? What I would do, basically, I convert the query also into the propositional query. So if in fact the only database, the only constants are John and Richard, then this query is nothing but evil John or evil Richard. That's the query. And I prove that. Okay? Same way, if my query is it true that everybody is evil? Is it true that for all x, evil x? Okay? That would become evil John and evil Richard. Okay. So this, what I just showed you is, where did I go? Yeah, right. What I just showed you is that I could go from a first order logic database and a first order query to a propositional database and a propositional query and use the machinery of the propositional logic to just give you, you know, give the truth and falsity, to compute the truth and falsity of the entailment. Okay? Everything works fine. This, you should understand this. It's a pretty obvious idea. The only problem, of course, is when there are function symbols. Okay? Because what happens when you have function symbols is that the number of constants is no longer, in this case, the constants were just 2. But once you have function symbols, the number of objects referent become infinite. We talked about this. Okay? The most interesting part of making sure that first order logic has semantics, that there is a way of computing entailment in first order logic, even in that case, is basically to realize that even when there are function symbols, theorems that can be proved would wind up being provable on a finite set of the propositional version. So the idea is, anytime I say a database, you assume it's a finite size database. Okay, when I say first order logic database, it's a finite sized first order logic database. We don't talk about infinitely large first order logic databases. Okay, if I have a finite, this is a finite size first order logic database, and one of the nice things that happened here is I can convert it into a finite sized propositional database. That is no longer going to hold if I have a function symbol, because then a finite first order database corresponds to an infinitely large propositional database. However, it turns out that you can think of we'll see in a minute that you can think of the infinitely large propositional database in like layers. So the idea would be that first you would consider only the propositional part that includes zeroth depth symbol. That means wherever there is a term, so such as John, Richard, etc., they would be constant directly. Okay? And then I can consider up to 0 and 1 depth symbol. That means suppose I actually now throw in father off as a function into this database. So up to here I would have only considered John and Richard. From here to here I would also have considered John, Richard, and father of John, father of Richard. Those are 0 and 1 depth. And then I can go further down. This would be John, Richard, father of John, father of Richard, father of John, father of Richard. Okay? If you do this, basically you're sort of looking at pieces of the database at a time. This thing goes all the way down to infinity. However, the semi-decidability theorem essentially says that if you are trying to prove a theorem, if you gave a theorem at the first order level, if it is actually provable, that means it is entailed, then there exists a finite depth propositional database from which you can prove it. And so if you think of iteratively increasing the size of the propositionalization until the theorem gets proved, if the theorem is in fact provable, you would stop at some finite depth. If the theorem is not provable, you will be going on and on and on and on. Okay? And for those of you, if you're looking for some interesting analogies, although this is not a very good analogy in a complexity theoretic terms, remember when we were talking about planning graphs, I said you can look for plans directly as subgraphs of the planning graph. We used mostly planning graphs as heuristics. But you could also have looked for plans as subgraphs of planning graphs. In fact, the original graph plan algorithm did that. Okay? Now, how would you do that? What you do is you would construct a planning graph of size 1, see if a subgraph of that corresponds to a valid plan. If so, you are done. If not, you extend it to size 2, see if there is a subgraph of it which corresponds to a planning graph, a valid plan. If so, you are done. If not, 3, if not, 4, if not, 5. Okay? And so it's basically, that's the sort of thing that you're doing here. Obviously, graph plan cannot be an analogy for first order logic because this thing came much before that. But in essence, that's what we're doing. We're stratifying the database, looking at whether theorem can be proved in a small piece first, if not little bigger, if not little bigger. Okay? Where the way you're increasing the database size is in terms of the depth of the symbols considered. Now, to make this all more, slightly more formal, we talk about Mr. Herbrand. Basically, you can think in terms of two ideas, Herbrand universe and Herbrand base. Okay? Given a first order logic database, here I'm using this, for all xy, friend xy implies life xy, friend Rao Pat and friend Pat son of Rao. Now, son of is a function symbol. Okay? So given a first order database, then the Herbrand universe for this database consists of all the objects which have names, in essence. That's what it means. Herbrand universe is the universe of objects that are sort of mentioned in this first order database, either directly or implicitly. Okay, so all constants are mentioned. So Rav, Pat, they are part of the Herbrand universe. Okay, and then all ground functional terms are also things that have been mentioned implicitly. Okay. So because of which the moment you have a single function, then son of Rao, son of Pat, son of Rao, son of Pat, and so on. Okay? So the size of the Herbrand universe is equal to the number of constants normally and is equal to infinite if there exists even a single functional symbol. Okay. Now there's a little small detail. What if I have a first order database which does not have any constants mentioned there at all? Okay. So for example, all the statements are quantified statements. That's possible. Then all I need to do is I'll just make up a special constant. I'll call it K. And throw that as one of the constants and then use that to develop the functional terms. Okay. So this is the Herbrand universe. Now, Hebron base is the propositionalization of the first order database by plugging in elements from the Hebron universe and putting it into wherever terms are there. Okay? So basically, to get the Hebron base, it has to be a ground atomic sentences. That's what Hebron base is. It's a set of ground atomic sentences. Now, why are those interesting? So basically, Hebron base is King, in for this case, Hebron base is King John, Greedy John, Evil John, Brother Richard John. That's the set of, that's the Hebron base. That basically corresponds to all the symbols in the Hebron base correspond to propositional symbols, essentially. Okay? Now, how is the Hebron base related to the Hebron universe? You essentially take things from the universe and plug it into the predicate terms, the argument for predicates. Okay? So all ground atomic sentences that can be made with terms in the Hebron universe are the Hebron base. Okay? That's it. And so, for example, I can say, now the only predicates I have are friend and like. Okay? So the kind of ground terms I can make is friend Rao Pat, friend Pat Rao, friend Pat Pat, friend Rao Rao, friend Rao, son of Rao, friend son of Rao, son of Pat. Those are some of the elements of the Hebron base. And a whole bunch of such terms with like instead of friend would also be part of the Hebron base. Okay? And if you don't have any functions, then you can actually uniquely write down the Hebron base. In particular, here is like a little combinatorial calculation. If the Hebron universe size is n, that means there are n things, n constants in the Hebron universe, and if you have KRE predicates in the original database, then the size of the Hebron base would be p times n power k. That's pretty easy to see. Okay? And of course, the moment there are functions, this n is infinite, and so this is p times infinity power k, and so the whole thing is infinite. Okay? So that's basically, why is this whole thing useful? Because in essence, you're thinking, given a first order database, you ask yourself, what is the size of the Hebron base? And if you know the size of the Hebron base, then you know exactly how many propositions are needed to represent this. And you just draw a truth table of 2 power that size, and you're in business in doing your entailment. Okay? Now, of course, the only question, of course, is what happens when there are indeed infinite number of terms? And this is the point I was making earlier. Hebron is famous because essentially he pointed out that if a sentence alpha is entailed by a first order logic database or knowledge base, then it is entailed by a finite subset of the propositionalization of the first order logic database. This is a pretty darn good idea. I mean, you know, if you know for this for sure, then you can work on this idea, which is start with all zeroth depth symbols, then 0 and 1 depth, then 0 and 2 depth, 0, 1 and 2, 0, 1, 2 and 3 and so on until you find the proof. Okay, so that's basically the loop. So n equal to 0 to infinity, do create a propositional large base by instantiating only with depth n terms. Okay, so you can talk about, previously we talked about Hebron universe as if it's a whole single set, but you can say Hebron universe of depth 0, which is just constant. Hebron universe of depth 1, which will be constant, and first level function symbols applied to constant. And Hebron universe of depth 2, which has two levels of functions applied to constant. Okay? And so, in essence, what you're doing is you are computing those Hebron universes, and you know, given a Hebron universe, you have an Hebron base, and then you are looking at the propositional database for that, drawing the truth table and checking the entailment. Okay? So this is actually a powerful insight. You don't expect to do this day to day. But neither did you actually do entailment by truth tables for propositional logic. right? Did you do truth table based proposition entailment? No, we actually do proof theoretic entailment most of the time. But the semantics, that ultimately the soundness and completeness of proof theoretic entailment is always judged with respect to model theoretic entailment. And this is where the model theoretic entailment is being computed. Okay? Questions on this? Yes.
For a purely working on paper basis, maybe not on computers but on paper, you could essentially with this method, because you can do the truth table based entailment, you could also do it using resolution refutation.
Yeah, but don't talk about it. So basically think of resolution refutation, I mean think of this as converting first order logic theorem proving into propositional theorem proving. Now, how you do propositional theorem proving, still you have a choice. You could do it by model theory, which would be actually drawing the truth table, or you could do resolution truth table, resolution inference. Okay? Other questions? Okay. Okay. Before we go off, what about Gödel? Some of you obviously might be wondering to the extent you know about Gödel's incompleteness theorem. In essence, what Gödel's incompleteness theorem says is that in any sufficiently rich axiomatic system, there are theorems which are true but cannot be shown to be true. So it's even worse than the semi-decidability. Semi-decidability is saying theorems that are true would be shown to be true. Theorems that are false, you would never know. Okay, so when you're doing this looping, in essence, you don't know if you are at the loop n equal to 3,559,000,000,000. That's the nth value right now. Should we give up and say for sure the theorem is not true? Or say maybe the next iteration it will be provable. Okay. Semi-decidability says that if it is provable, at some finite depth it gets proved. If it's not provable, you'll just keep waiting. Gödel's basically saying that even theorems that are true cannot actually be proved. Okay, that's the point. And thankfully, Gödel's incompleteness theorem doesn't apply for first order logic, because remember it says any sufficiently rich axiomatic system. Turns out first order logic, because it's first order, is not rich enough. Why? Because in fact the Gödel's incompleteness theorem, for those of you who actually looked at the text as a nice example as to how the proof goes, it requires essentially for you to axiomatize arithmetic as part of first order logic. And in particular, axiomatize a thing that you know quite well called mathematical induction, which basically says if a property P is true for 0, and whenever it is true for number n, it's also true for number n plus 1, then it is true for all numbers, for natural numbers. This is the mathematical induction, right? All of you know this. It's a very nice statement that can be completely misused in all sorts of places. There are huge, you know, jokes on this. But anyway, you know that this is mathematical induction. You can't write this down as a finite first-order logic statement. Why? For the same reason why you can't write down a statement like all predicates are symmetric. Remember, I was talking to you about it last class. To say all predicates are symmetric, you have to quantify our predicates first. You can't. In first order, you can only quantify over terms. Okay? And so, what saves us really is this mathematical induction axiom is actually an axiom schema for first order logic. And for every possible predicate, you need to write it specifically, that predicate. For predicate P1, this is true. For predicate P2, this is true. That's the only way you can do it. So thankfully, first order logic winds up being just short of being sufficiently rich for incompleteness theorem to hold from the Gödel's point of view. But mathematicians were really, really mad at Gödel because they are not just interested in first order logic, they are interested in first order logic with mathematical induction thrown in, because at least arithmetic should be part of it. Okay. And you know all the history, those of you who care about it probably know the history, that there was all this great interest in the turn of the century in trying to axiomatize all of mathematics such that you can just mechanically prove whether a theorem is true or false by using some first order logic theorem prover. And people, I mean mathematicians couldn't care less as to how big such a machine has to be. You know, like remember that Archimedes said that give me a long enough lever and a place to put a fulcrum and I can lift the universe. Now you wonder where the heck was he trying to stand, you know, if he's not in the universe. But you know, mathematically speaking, yeah, it looks like a good idea. You know, it's like a big enough lever and a nice fulcrum somewhere, and you put this thing and then you lift it up. Okay. So from that point of view, they were wondering, you know, maybe you don't need mathematics as a separate discipline. You will just have first order logic theorem provers which someday, you know, they already understood that first order logic theorem provers can be made. You know, Hebron's theorem, etc., was in place already. So they were just wondering whether we can axiomatize the entire mathematics. And the people were writing books on this. And then I think there's this classic thing, Frege, I believe, is the guy who took the time to write a large book on how to axiomatize mathematics and all that stuff. And in the last minute was sent, some of these cracks in the firmament. And the last crack, of course, was Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which sort of made people realize that you don't expect to be able to mechanically prove it. Okay. Gödel himself is a very, very interesting character. There's a story that he was a second scientist to be called to Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, where Einstein spent most of his non-productive life. You know, when he went there, he was mostly saying the kind of calendar sayings of that we know of Einstein, you know, like I believe in a God who is Spinoza's God kind of thing. Before that, he was busy actually writing papers. After that, he was saying these sorts of things. So Gödel was actually there, and Gödel was a famous recluse. He would not talk to anybody, and every once in a while, maybe, you know, every multiple months, he might say hello to Einstein. And apparently, at one point of time, he had to take a citizenship test, because otherwise he was going to be deported. And so, it turns out that to get American citizenship, there will be a silly test that you have to take, where they'll ask you a couple of questions like, you know, how many legs did the first president have, and you have to answer that. And so this guy was given a little driver's manual kind of a thing about American history, and he read this, and he found that the Constitution was inconsistent. And in fact, it is actually possible to follow the Constitution and allow dictatorship in America. We know this by now after John Ashcroft, but at that time people didn't know, right? And he was excited. He wanted to share this knowledge with the guy who would be interviewing him for citizenship. As it is, this guy is of Germanic descent, and you know, people are very worried. This is Second World War time. And here's a guy who wants to show the citizenship guy that, by the way, your Constitution sucks, here is the way it is wrong. And so then they essentially had to cool him down, make him drink a couple of drinks or something, and then stop him from saying this. You know, so he was finally a citizen of the U.S. Okay. But, so anyway, that's the connection with Gödel's incompleteness theorem and what we are talking about. We just dodged the bullet, basically. Okay. Because by writing this, you would not have a finite first-order database. You would have an infinitely large first-order database. Okay, so proof theoretic entailment. You know, all that stuff is really to get you a feel for why do we think that we can prove theorems. Okay, conceptually, why do we think we can prove theorems? So that version of theorem proving, obviously, in first-order logic is, again, as I said last time and I mentioned again, it's this version of derivation, definition of derivatives. Limit h tends to 0, fx plus h minus fx by h. That's the definition of a derivative. When was the last time you used this? Of course, when was the last time you ever did any derivation? As a computer science student, I guess that was at least 10 years back. But even if you were actually doing differentiation, you barely ever used this. because there is, you know, there are nice rules like a chain rule and all these things that you use, rather than if you ever find yourself using this in the middle of the exam, you know you're sunk. Because, because, you know, especially limited term exams. Anyway, so similarly, if you ever find yourself drawing a nice little Herbrand universe and Herbrand base to solve, you know, prove that a first order logic theorem is true, you're sunk. Okay, because that's too easy. So thankfully, we have proof theoretic inferences. This actually should go easily enough. It turns out that most of the things that are true for propositional logic will also hold directly for first order logic. Now, when we're doing proof theoretic inference, you notice that we would no longer talk about propositionalization. We are trying to do it native. We're trying to solve proof theorems directly in first order without actually propositionalizing it. In particular, what you would like to do is sort of demand-driven propositionalization. Okay? And you'll see what I mean in a minute. So first of all, the following things are true. For ground sentences, the old inference rules all hold. Okay? So for example, if PAB implies QA and, let's see, what did I say? Okay, and PAB implies QA and PAB is true, that then this whole thing together entails Q of A. That's just mod exponent with some extra parentheses thrown in to make it ugly. Okay. And similarly, I can talk about resolution. If not PAB or QA is true in your database, and if you have PAB true, this can be resolved to get QA. Of course, resolution is a general case of everything, and so in this case, you're able to do the same thing on the top using resolution. Okay, so all the ground versions of propositional inference rules still hold in first order logic too. Okay, of course, one of the interesting things is what can we do for quantified sentences? Okay, before you see the rest of that slide, let me just show you this slide first and say that there are two extra rules of inference that you throw in just to handle first order logic. Okay, two extra rules of inference. One is called universal instantiation, one is called existential instantiation. And those are the only things that what they do is they take a quantified sentence and give you a ground sentence. Okay, and now once you have ground sentence, you can do ground inference rule. Okay, so what universal instantiation says is if you ever have a sentence for all v alpha, okay, you can substitute any term G for V and write alpha. So in alpha, you can substitute wherever V was occurring in this sentence alpha, you can put G in it. That would still be true. Okay, that's all it's saying. So this is like saying, for all X, happy X, I can write it as happy Rav, because Rav is a term, so I can throw Rav instead of X and that would be true. For every possible substitution of X, I can write one of those. So if I say for all X, happy X, then I can write one of these ground sentences for every possible ground term. Okay? So in particular here, they're showing for all X, king X and greedy X implies evil X. This, if you universal instantiation, you can get this. King John and greedy John implies evil John. You can also get this. And if you have father thrown in, then you can also get these sentences by universal instantiation. Now, it's not necessary, just because you can draw this doesn't mean you must write these. Remember one of the biggest things from the Sherlock Holmes joke. There are too many things that you can infer. And wise people only infer the things that are relevant to what it is that they want to prove. Right? So just because, I mean, if you suddenly try to write a universal instantiation rule to completion, then you'll never do anything else because you just keep writing all the sentences. But all I'm saying is if you do write those instantiated sentences, they will be entailed. Not surprising. Okay, and in fact, how do you prove that this is sound and complete? You have to do it with respect to the model theory that we just talked about, using Herbrand universe and Herbrand basis. And what's more interesting is the existential instantiation, where if you have an existential statement, okay, then you can take a constant symbol, okay, K, which does not currently appear anywhere in the database. That's very important. It should not appear anywhere in the database. Okay, and then put that in place of the existential. So for example, if I say there exists X, happy X, okay, and in this room I'm standing and I'm saying there exists X, happy X, the temptation is to pick one of yourselves and put there. Okay, you may not be the right person who actually is the happy person. Okay, so I would look at this universe and find somebody who is not here. Okay, so someone completely outside of this universe, in this database, and let's say, you know, Jermaine, and then say, happy Jermaine. The only reason I decided Jermaine is happy is because Jermaine is not here and you don't know who Jermaine is. Okay, so all the, this is called columnization. All this is saying is, if the existential statement is true, it means there exists some constant whose identity you just happen not to know, for which the statement actually holds. So it's still useful because you now got rid of a variable and you wrote a constant. Okay? This is called columnization, and we'll actually find this useful later on. Now notice that in a minute we'll be talking about modus ponens, generalized modus ponens. And it turns out that existential is inherently conjunctive or disjunctive. You cannot have it both ways. It's disjunctive. Okay? And what did I say is a bad thing? Conjunction or disjunction? Disjunction. Remember that surgeon story. Okay, disjunction is a bad thing. Okay? So you expect not to see existential statements. So, for example, you expect not to see existential statements when you are talking about generalized modus ponens. Okay, so you won't see this for the rest of today's class. Okay, and then it will again make its appearance when we start talking about full theorem proving with respect to resolution refutation, where you will be able to handle both disjunction and conjunction. Now, one thing I want you to notice is in the universal quantification, the substitution is for any variable V and any ground term G, that ground term G can be part of the database. In fact, it is part of all, you write it with respect to a term that is in the database. This one, this is a constant that's not in the database. It's from outside. Yes. You'll see. Okay. In fact, what it helps you is columnization helps you prove things without showing the object. How many of you know existential versus constructive proofs? You guys did math, right? So constructive proof is one where I'm asking, does there exist an object which has the following property P? Okay? An existential proof says, yes, it does. And when they are done, you still don't know what is the name of that object. Okay? And a constructive proof says, yes, it does. And here is that object. Okay? Columnization, for example, would be useful in carrying out existential proofs. Okay? So, for example, suppose I told you the following statement. What is my statement? So I left my keys either at home or at office. And I ask you, do you think my keys are someplace? What's the answer? Yes. Where? Home or office. Okay. You want to be able to prove this. Because the keys haven't disappeared off the face of Earth. They are either at home or office. So that's an existential proof. Keys do exist. It's just that where they exist, there is a question. And you cannot do this in modus ponens. You can do it with resolution theorem proving. And in doing that, you do columnization. Okay. Now, the question is, I was at this stage, and I said, you have, these will always hold. And now that you know that universal instantiation is a valid rule, then if I have suppose I had, instead of this particular fact is not there, instead I have this fact in my database, for all x and for all y, P of XY implies Q of X. That's what my database, my knowledge is. Now, universal instantiation will give me this. And this, with this, gives me this. Okay? So if I have a database where I have just this sentence and P of AB, you would like to be able to directly say Q of AB, Q of A. And it's really a two-step inference. Inference step one, universal instantiate, and then inference step two, do a ground modus ponens. The question is, can we package these? In fact, that's what you do. You, without thinking, you essentially say, I have for all xy, p of xy implies q of x, p of ab is true, so obviously x is a, y is b, so q of b is true. This thing that I said, oh, x is a, y is b, that means p of xy becomes p of ab, that's called unification. I'm matching this guy with this guy and finding the substitution which will make p of ab equal to p of xy. And carrying that same substitution here. Okay, so these two will become equal if x equal to a, y equal to b, and then if you apply the same substitution, x equal to a, y equal to b, to q of x, you will get q of b. Okay, so generalized modus ponens, inference rule called generalized modus ponens, which is sort of a macro inference rule, which combines universal instantiation with ground modus ponens. Okay, directly allows you to take this and this and write this. Yes. 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 I'm sorry. Should be here. Now, obviously. Yeah. Obviously, to do this correctly. I mean, to do this, essentially, you have to, you notice that the reason generalized modus ponens is useful is you are instantiating as in a demand-driven fashion. You, or at least you could instantiate in a demand-driven fashion. If what you're trying to prove, so in essence, what we are trying to do is, you know, when I'm matching P of AB through P of XY, I will get specific instantiation. So indirectly I'm writing P of AB implies Q of A and then use the modus ponens. Okay? Whereas if you did universal instantiation completely in the beginning, you would have done so much work, much of which would be wasted. Okay? Now it turns out that, so we'll talk about two things for the rest of the class. One is this notion of unification. How do you match two predicate symbols, two predicate symbols, two atomic sentences, essentially. Okay? And the second is, how would you use the generalized modus ponens to do theorem proving? And in terms of the second one, you could do generalized modus ponens in the forward direction. So, whenever you have this, for every PAB, suppose my database contains this statement, and for a whole bunch of A1, AI, BI, it contains P of AI, BI. So I equal to 1 to 10,000, it contains P of AI, BI is true. All I wanted to prove is Q of A 700. Q of A 700. Now, it turns out that I can use the generalized modus ponens in the forward direction, where for every P of AI, BI, I match it and derive Q of AI, and one of the 10,000 Q of AIs I derive happens to be Q of A 700, so I say I'm done. That's going in the forward direction. Okay? Or I can do it in the backward direction. I can say, look, what I want to prove is Q of A 700, and to be able to prove Q of A 700, I need to be, in essence, prove P of A 700 and something else. and then see if there is anybody here who would match with Q of A700 and something else, and it turns out there will only be one term, Q of A700, P of A700, B700, and you match those two. Backward is much better if all you are trying to prove is one theorem. And prolog does backward generalized mod exponent. That's what it does. Forward is better if you need to give all the answers. If I need to find out all the answers, all the x's for which Q of x are true, then trying to prove each x separately is much more costly. So going forward is more useful in those cases. Okay, so forward generalized mod exponents is taking the large data view of the world. That means you have a large amount of data and each answer would be large number of tuples. And not surprisingly, database people who actually use a version of first order logic called data log and have an area called deductive databases tend to favor forward inferences. Prolog does backward inference. And there is, in fact, it turns out there is smart ideas which combine both. We'll talk about that in a minute. So let me talk about unification first, and then forward and backward. Okay. So unification is, I'll mostly give you examples. It's not that hard a concept. So suppose I have like one piece is knows John X, the other piece is knows John Jane. What must I substitute for what such that they will become equal? Unification is find me a mapping of terms. Okay? So I can, and the restriction is you cannot map a constant to a different constant. You can only map a variable to a term. So a unifier basically is of the type a variable is mapped to a term. A term is essentially can be another variable, can be constant, can be function of terms, all that fun stuff. That's what a unifier is. And a maximally general unifier is, of course, a unifier such that there is no other substitution that will make these two things equal, which cannot be derived from the general one. So to understand that, suppose I have two terms, Q, X, Y, and Q, Tom, V. Okay? I can make these two things equal by setting X equal to Tom and Y equal to Jane and V equal to Jane. Agreed? They will become equal. I can also make them equal by saying X equal to Tom, Y equal to V, which is a more general way of making them equal. Both of them will make them equal. So the idea is like you have, you have two kids and you want to make them look equal, look alike. I don't know why I'm thinking of this right now. And one of them has long hair, one of them has short hair. And let's say then you could basically cut both their hairs, they will look equal. Or you can wait for one of them to grow more hair. Okay, these are two different ways of making them equal. Okay, or making them look equal. And in this case, I made X equal to Tom, Y equal to V. Here I said X equal to Tom, Y equal to Jane, V equal to Jane, which is sort of like taking these two kids and making them look like a third person. Okay, which will also make them look same. Okay, and the reason this is more general is you can start with this and do an extra mapping, V equal to Jane, and you'd get the top one. So that's why this one is more general than this. And what you're doing in doing inference in unification normally is you're looking for maximally general unifier. Okay? So in this case, maximally general unifier would be X equal to Jn. In this case, maximally general unifier would be Y equal to John, X equal to OJ. Okay? In this case, what is the maximally general unifier? So actually, in fact, in doing this, we can actually go step by step. One way of making unification, and in fact, I don't remember either I give you the unification code or you write the unification code in the next project. So you better pay attention if it's the second idea. So I have nodes. If I'm doing this, right, I will have something like this, nodes. John, X, and then I have nodes, Y, and then what's the other one? Mother Y. Okay? In trying to unify these, this is what I can do. I'll start, first check whether both the lists are equal sized. If they're not equal sized, they're not going to be unifiable. Okay? And then if they're equal sized, then I check the car and check if the cars are equal. Okay? The first is equal. In this particular case, the first is already equal. If first, because the first is equal, then the equality depends only on the coulomb, the second part of it. Right? Now, to make the second part equal, I'll basically say, is John equal to Y? John is not equal to Y, but you can make John equal to Y. If you say, Y is John. So I will make that commitment right now. I will say, okay, I'll continue on from here and say John and Y are the same by setting Y equal to John. But part of that commitment now is to put this in the rest of the thing. So the moment I said Y equal to John, I substitute it here. There is no Y here, so nothing changes. I also substitute it here. So in fact, this becomes nodes John and then mother John. Now I need to see if X can be made equal to mother John. Turns out it's not already equal, but if you set X equal to mother John, I mean if you map X equal to mother John, it will become equal. So then I'll say, well, it is equal if you also say X is mother John. It's a nice recursive procedure that I just showed you. So you recurse first at the first level. If you fail there, you go back saying not unifiable. If not, you go to the second level, try to unify. If it is unifiable, then you send, you keep this unifier with you and try to unify the rest. Now when these guys get unified, they will return with this piece. You in essence concatenate it with this piece. That would be your unifier. Okay? And this will be a maximally general unifier because of the way we are doing it. Okay. So nodes John X, nodes Y mother Y would unify if Y equal to John and X equal to mother John. Okay? Question? It's not that hard. This is basically pattern matching. And one of the nice things is, for once, I don't remember still whether I asked you to do unification or not, but if you see the unification code, whether you write it or whether I already gave it to you, it's so much easier to do in Lisp, you know, than in some other language where the only data type is a string. Okay? So the last one. Yes, sir. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay. When there are two variables, you can map anything to anything.
But in this case, we have one variable and the other one is constant.
Yeah, whenever there's one of them is variable, other is a constant, you must always map the variable to a constant.
Yeah.
Okay? Otherwise, if the both are variables, it doesn't matter. You know, happy X and happy Y can be made equal either by making X to the same as Y or Y the same as X, and it doesn't make any difference. Yes.
To do the continue that.
Yes, yes, yes. So that's the important thing. So you are throwing this mapping in, okay?
Yeah, even the variable to variable. So if you do x, if you map x to y, then there is no y in the
rest. Exactly, exactly. I mean, if you map x to y, there is no x left. Everything becomes y. Okay. Now, of course, knows John X, knows X O J. Can that be unified by our definition? It would have come here, knows, knows, fine. Then it will say John X, yeah, X equal to John. So then I have to say this is John now and this is O J. Because I said X equal to John. And John and O J cannot be unified because they are two constants. They can't be made equal. Yes? There are millions of non-unifiable cases, you know, obviously, but this is one simple example, okay? In this case, basically, the moment it looks as if, upfront it looks as if, yeah, I can make x equal to John here, x equal to OJ there, but there's only one x, okay? Now, one of the interesting things is, so this is, if you ever actually find yourself unifying knows John X and knows X OJ, right? This is the right thing to say. It is the right thing to say that these two cannot be unified. But suppose actually, how did you get here? Maybe you got here because there were two different sentences in your knowledge base. Imagine knows is I, so knows John X, that's one sentence, and for all X, knows X, OJ. Okay, and imagine for a minute that knows is a unidirectional one. So, Rao knows you means Rao knows your existence. You don't know Rao's existence. It's like Rao knows Bush. Bush, I don't think, realizes that I exist. Okay? So, in this case, knows essentially means this sentence is saying John knows everybody, but they don't know that the unknowns them. Okay? So John knows everybody, their names at least. This says everybody knows OJ. OJ himself is oblivious of people's existence, but everybody knows OJ. Now in this case, actually these two should be unifiable. For example, is it true that John knows OJ? Yeah, because John knows everybody, so he also knows OJ. So I shouldn't be failing in this unification. And yet I will, if I ever write this as knows John X and knows X OJ. To avoid that problem, you do something called standardizing variables apart. I would say this is equivalent to for all X1 knows John X1, and this one it says for all X2 knows X2 OJ. All I'm doing is changing the variable name. These two variables are under two different quantifiers. So I can always change the quantifier, the variable's name and the quantifier, and the sentence doesn't change. Right? So if I did this before I started unifying, then I would not get into this trouble. Okay? So in the Prolog project, you would be asked to do standardization of variables step. And you know why. Because otherwise you would not have been able to see in this case, for example, that, there may have been a scenario where for all X knows X OJ implies hates X OJ. Okay? Suppose I have these two sentences. John knows everybody. Anybody who knows OJ hates OJ. I want to be able to prove whether, I want to check whether John hates OJ. You guys know. That's why everybody hates OJ. So John also hates OJ in this case. Okay, you know that's true statement. But if you did not standardize the variables apart, these things wouldn't have unified, and so you wouldn't have been able to prove that theorem. Okay? Yes? Yeah, so if I have these two sentences in my database, okay, one is for all X knows John X. That means John knows everybody. And another sentence says for all X knows X OJ implies hates X OJ. So it's like knowing OJ is like hating him. Okay. Now, given these two sentences, you should be able to prove, you can see from these sentences that John hates OJ, because John knows everybody, so John knows OJ. And if John knows OJ, if anybody knows OJ, they will hate them. They will hate OJ. So given these two sentences, you should be able to prove the theorem hates John OJ. And it's a true theorem. And so your prologue should be able to prove that. Okay? And furthermore, if I just had this and I ask the question, does there exist an X such that hates X OJ? It should say yes and X equal to John. Because this is the guy who knows everybody, and because he knows everybody, he knows OJ, and because he knows OJ, he hates OJ. That's your explanation why this guy hates. You should be able to prove this. And you better not let some little syntactic niggly thing come in the way of proving this. And the syntactic niggly thing that can come in the way is if fortuitously the variables happen to have the same name. It's like if you have an X in your program and he has an X in his program, those are not the same X. In your program, if you have an X, you better have some specific semantics for that X. You can't keep changing it. But he's in a different, if you are a different for all, then you are in a different X altogether. No. By the time you come to unification, you don't get to standardize. You'll see this as the prologue goes. So it turns out that unification is an interior step in theorem proving. When you are ready to unify, you already did all the standardizations. And if after standardization they still have this, that means they should not really be unifiable. Okay? How about this? Knows XFX and knows UU. What happens in this case? So knows will work. And then I can make X and U equal by mapping X to U. The moment I map X to U, this becomes F of U and this becomes U. So now I'm trying to map F of U to U. Is that okay? U is a variable, F of U is a term. Why can't I do that? Well, there's an infinite regress. Because if you map U to F of U, then the inside of that thing also is F of, you know. So you don't allow. So there's one extra check we do, which is, I already said that a mapping always maps a variable to a term, but a unifier should map a variable to a term that doesn't have an instance of this variable in it. Because if you map yourself to something that exists you, then you know, all things go wrong, you know, infinite regress. Okay? So this is called Occur's check. And believe it or not, it's painful enough to do it in the interior of the prologue compilers that sometimes they will avoid doing the check and take the consequences later. But you should do to get the unification correct, you should not let this and this unify, because it makes no sense for them to unify. So something as simple as mapping actually turns out to be interesting. You know, the unification turns out to be interesting. And then once you know the mapping and the unification, this is the rule for generalized modus ponens. All this is saying is, if I have a bunch of things, P1, etc., Pn dash, and I have a single implication, P1 and P2, etc., Pn implies Q, and it turns out that these are unifiable with these, okay? And the unification is theta. Okay, that's the mapping. Then you apply the same unification to Q, same mapping to Q, and you can write that version of Q as a sentence that's valid. So for example, if I have King John, let's see, what are we saying? What is it doing here? So King is, P dash is King John, P1 is King X. Okay, so if this one is saying for all x, king x and greedy x implies evil x. And this is king John, this is greedy John. Okay? And so in fact, one of the things that you will also do in the project, and it's actually been brought out there, is you're trying to unify King John and greedy John, this whole thing, with King X and greedy X. And so whatever you did to make these two unify, it better be the case that that is pushed into this. Okay, so for example, suppose my sentence says that for all X, King X and greedy X implies evil X. Okay, and suppose I have King John and greedy Richard. I shouldn't be able to prove anything in this case. Because yes, King John is the king, but John is not greedy. So to do this, when you are trying to unify this with this, you would realize X equal to J, and then you apply that X here, and now you are trying to prove greedy J. Greedy J is not true, so this part is not holding. If it does hold, so if this, instead of R, if this was John, then it would hold with X equal to John. Then you apply that X equal to John to evil X, and you get to write evil John into the database. Just mechanics. Okay? Let me skip and show this for a minute, because I would like you to be able to start looking at the project for this session. I'll complete this discussion again next class. Here is a very simple example. I'm not going to go through it because we don't have time, but I want you to show you how you can follow this. Suppose this is a pet example, apartment pet example. It says, you know, for all x, small x and pet x implies apartment pet. That means if it's a pet, it's a thing that you can keep as a pet, and it's small enough, then you can keep it as an apartment pet. Dogs are pets, cats are pets, elephants can also be pets, skunks are small, cats are small, dogs are small, Fido is a dog, Louis is a skunk, Garfield is a cat, Clyde is an elephant, and my question is, are there any apartment pets in your universe? And I'll try to do this in the backward direction, because that's what the project will ask you to do, and that's also what Solar does. So I will try to see, is apartment pet X true? The way I'll do it is, I'll start from the top of the database to the bottom, looking for any statement whose head unifies with apartment pet. So this one unifies with apt pet X. So if I make this and this equal, then I can show something is an apartment pet X if I can show that it is small and it's a pet. So I'm trying to show one thing, I now have to sub-goal on showing two different things. To try small, I consider every possible way of trying something to be small. And the first thing I show to be small happens to be Louis. Small Louis is true. Okay? One way of being small is being skunk, and Louis is a skunk, and so Louis is small. Now I need to be able to take this binding for X, which is Louis, push it here, and show that Louis can be a pet. And thankfully, this database says that skunks cannot be pets. Okay? So at this point, you have done all this work, and then you say, oops, Louis cannot be a pet, that because Louis is not a dog, Louis is not a cat, Louis is not an elephant. Those are the only pets. And so Louis is not a pet. So then now I come back here and try to get somebody else who is small and see if they can be pet. Okay? This is essentially the innards of a Prolog theorem prover. It tries to prove a theorem by picking a rule whose head happens to be the theorem, and then sub-goals on the antecedents of that theorem, antecedents of that rule, and tries to recursively prove each of the antecedents. The only question, of course, is in trying to prove these antecedents, they are connected to each other because of the common variables. So this x dash is the same as this x dash here. So whatever x dash you use here to make this happy, you have to apply that x dash there too. And this is called the sideways information crossing, sideways binding passing. And because of which sometimes the thing that's small is not a pet. And sometimes, and so you may have to backtrack again. Okay? I'll stop here. We'll talk more about both backward and forward reasoning as well as resolution repetition next class.